You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 22nd of April 2022 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Hello, this is The Globalist, broadcasting to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. Coming up on today's programme...
I'm announcing another $800 million to further augment Ukraine's ability to fight in the east, in the Donbas region. This package includes heavy artillery weapons, dozens of howitzers, and 144,000 rounds of ammunition.
That was the US President Joe Biden. But why are decision-makers in Germany so reluctant to offer Ukraine similar support? Also ahead, Monocle's Tokyo Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson will be telling us why Japan is concerned about a security pact between the Solomon Islands and China. Plus, the Westminster watcher Vincent McAvaney examines the day's papers, Kat Hannah has the latest urbanism news, and then Monocle's contributing editor Andrew Muller will be unpacking some of the week's offbeat news stories.
We learned this week of another puncture in F. Scott Fitzgerald's maxim that there are no second acts in American life.
That's all ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. Officials in Shanghai have said they will tighten the enforcement of lockdown measures as COVID numbers in the Chinese city continue to surge. The former president of Honduras, Juan Orlando Hernandez, has been extradited to the United States to face drug trafficking charges. And Group Le Monde has launched an English-language digital edition ahead of the French presidential election runoff on Sunday. Do stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on those stories. But first, on Wednesday, Russia announced that the country had successfully tested its new nuclear-capable Sarmat intercontinental ballistic missile ICBM system. Vladimir Putin said the missile, which has been dubbed Satan II by the West, will make those who, in the heat of frantic, aggressive rhetoric, try to threaten our country think twice. Well, US President Joe Biden yesterday announced that another $800 million in military aid for Ukraine. But one country, Germany, has come under mounting pressure over its dithering stance on sending heavy weapons to Ukraine. To unpack all of this, I'm joined now by Lada Roslicki, the founder and managing partner of Black Trident Defence and Security Consulting Group in Ukraine, and by Aaron Burnett, a journalist based in Berlin. Lada, let's start by discussing Russia's military capabilities. What is this new missile, this ICBM, capable of?
Well, hello. And this missile is an intercontinental ballistic missile, which can carry, I believe, up to 10 nuclear warheads. And it appears to be another part of Russia's nuclear saber rattling that is continuing to allow the Russian Federation to behave in a monstrous way, in a genocidal way against Ukraine. It is a part of its normal nuclear arms development. So when the Pentagon came out yesterday with a statement saying, don't panic, this is just a normal development, that is true. However, what we are concerned about here in Ukraine isn't so much about this particular missile, but more about the hypersonic weaponry and, in particular, tactical nuclear weapons that Russia is likely to be using in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And the question is, where are the red lines? How far is bureaucracy and red tape in the West going to allow the genocide to develop in Ukraine? It's actually quite scary.
Yeah. Now, Aaron, we've heard Ukraine's foreign minister frequently stress that what Ukraine really needs right now, and I quote, is weapons, weapons, weapons. We've just heard that obviously the United States is giving more weapons to Ukraine. But from where you are in Germany, why is your government so hesitant on this?
Good morning, Georgina. That really is the question of the hour in Berlin that I think probably at least 80% of political Berlin, at least, is trying to figure out, and that really only Olaf Scholz's chancellery knows the answer to. Olaf Scholz is increasingly out of step with many members of his own government, as well as members of his own governing parties. He's received a lot of criticism, as we've explored before on this very program, from even the chairs of his own Bundestag committees in defense, foreign affairs, Europe, for this dithering over heavy weapons. His foreign minister, Annalena Baerbock, of course, from the Greens, a different party, has already previously acknowledged the need for Germany to supply heavy weapons to Ukraine. This exact question is being debated all over German news programs, basically on a nightly basis. Why isn't Olaf Scholz prepared to send these heavy weapons to Ukraine? Over half of Germans polled recently say that Germany should send heavy weapons to Ukraine. So this really, the reluctance really is sitting with Scholz's chancellery. And Olaf Scholz really is the only person who knows precisely why he's still hesitant to send them. The biggest guess that we have, the biggest explanation we can probably offer, is that Olaf Scholz and a sizable portion of his Social Democrats are very worried about dragging Germany into the war, dragging NATO into the war, despite what allies think, and also despite all legal advice that's being given to the chancellery that says that supplying weapons does not constitute making Germany a party to the war in Ukraine.
But one excuse that is coming out, and this from one of the most senior army officers, is that Germany couldn't defend itself from an attack if it sends more heavy weapons to Ukraine. Is that true?
There's a lot of experts in Berlin, as well as some of his some of the important chairs of the Bundestag committees, such as defense, that have said that is really not true. That there's certainly weapons to spare. That there would be it would be a long time before war would ever reach Germany. It would probably go through Eastern allies first if that were to happen. And Germany is already offering to replace weapons that are sent via Eastern allies to Ukraine. Plus, the defense industry, the actual German defense industry, companies like Rheinmetall have said that no, this is not true either. There's lots of capacity to manufacture weapons and send them as the need exists.
Mm. Lada, does Ukraine buy this line from Germany?
No, Ukraine doesn't buy the line. And very unfortunately, memories of World War II are starting to arise. And the cooperation even before with German and Stalin and the entire approach towards Ukrainians as and other Slavs as Undermens. And we have to look at very carefully at the future of Germany. As we know, its relationship with Russia is very old and runs deep, far beyond its dependency on Russian gas and energy. We have to consider what power inside of Germany is going to do to ensure that Germany remains a leader of democracy and not a marionette of Russian corruption and Russian power. Mm. Right now, it's just not looking very good. And Germany also did not play the best role in supporting Ukraine and democracy with the 2014 invasion of the Russian Federation in Donbas and Luhansk territories, let alone Crimea. So Germany really has to make a decision, much like India. So like India is very dependent on Russia for its military and defense industry, about 52% plus minus. And in Germany is about the same amount reliable on energy sources from Russia. It's time for leadership to choose honor and support Ukraine with war, because if they choose the dishonorable route, they're going to get war anyway.
Yeah. I mean, Erin, it's interesting that Lada brings up World War II, and I wonder if this attitude from Schulz and his cabinet is really in relation to that, that of course the country is very pacifist minded and wants to prevent being involved in anything like that ever again.
Yes, but I think that we are, even on questions of what Germany's responsibility in Ukraine is relative to its history, I think we are increasingly seeing a division of opinion between Olaf Scholz's chancellor and especially his ruling Social Democrats, which, as Lada has pointed out, have a very cozy relationship previously with Putin's Russia and the rest of the public. We have a majority of the public in Germany that in recent polls that say that the government is not doing enough to support Ukraine. So I would probably contend that there is a different perception arising here within the public. We haven't really seen that to the same extent before. This willingness, I suppose, to re-examine what the lessons of history are, and perhaps to have a more having a more active international policy is the right way to go. I think that where we are seeing resistance is within the chancellery and the ruling party, and also within some entrenched foreign policy and defense elites who were essentially wrong about how the country was supposed to deal with Russia and its foreign and security policy, informed based on its history, but are still in influential positions, still giving the government advice, based on, I think, understandings and intelligence that have turned out to be wrong.
Mm. And finally, Lada, if I could just ask you about this next tranche of US aid, 800 million, but that includes heavy weaponry that Ukraine really needs.
Yeah. Well, Ukraine needs a lot more heavy weaponry than it's receiving from anybody. So spare parts to airplanes are not airplanes. Repair capabilities of tanks are not tanks. And Ukraine really needs to have a lot of heavy permanent weaponry, not just Stingers and machinery that can protect their skies, but basically throw away. If you can imagine, it's like having bullets rather than having a gun, and Ukraine needs both.
Lada, thank you very much. That's Lada Roslicky there and Erin Burnett. This is The Globalist on Monocle 24.
The Foreign Desk is Monocle 24's weekly global affairs programme. We tackle the world's biggest news stories, as well as those left untold.
If actually you speak to the ordinary people, their aspirations is for a unified country, whether you talk to business people, to school teachers, to market traders, and so on and so forth, across the board, is they want to see their country recreated as it was, only this time as a democratic, accountable system.
Our expert guests offer in-depth analysis and first-hand experience.
One of the Ebola treatment centres I went to had been burned down by a community that were very resentful and frightened of Ebola, and they still have a bunker in the middle. They've dug a big, deep bunker where they can hide if people come and shoot at them.
The Foreign Desk with me, Andrew Muller, is available every Saturday from midday London time, right here on Monocle 24.
Just coming up to 7:14 here in London, that's 8:14 in Paris, and that's where we go next for the latest on the French elections coming up on Sunday. And joining me now from Paris is Florence Biedermann, an AFP journalist. Good morning to you, Florence. Lovely to speak to you again. The two candidates, the incumbent Emmanuel Macron and the far-right leader Marine Le Pen, faced off in a television debate on Wednesday evening. Have the polls shifted since then?
Well, they were already clearly favoring Emmanuel Macron. He has a lead over Marine Le Pen of about 10 points. And after the debate, This lead increased slightly. Okay, whether it's really the direct result of the debate is, of course, difficult to know. But definitely, I mean, the common understanding was that Marine Le Pen didn't fare that well in this big debate. Mm.
The two last opposed each other at the ballot box in 2017. And I wonder how they personally, their parties and indeed France have changed in those 5 years since then.
Well, it is, unfortunately, you could say, change in the fact that now you are really wondering if the far right can come to power in France. I mean, this was not even a question 5 years ago. It was clear that Marine Le Pen would not win. 5 years later, there was two far right candidates in the election, Éric Zemmour, who disappeared in the meantime, and Marine Le Pen. And now, I mean, every serious analyst think there may still be a chance, even if it's a slight chance, that she comes to power. So definitely there was a shift to the extreme in the political landscape. And this is partly the result of, let's say, disaffection of voters, of a kind of perception that Emmanuel Macron has not been very empathetic with the people who have low revenues, that his policy was more favoring the rich. So there is really this polarization, which you saw in other countries, where you have the candidate supposedly representing the elite, Emmanuel Macron, and the candidate who styles herself are defending the people, who is Marine Le Pen.
And what does this mean then, this the weakening of traditional parties, the rise of the populists? What does it, this rejection really of the status quo, mean not just for France but for Europe?
Well, I mean, the result, if Le Pen arrived to power, would really be a catastrophe for the EU, definitely. The weakening of the main parties have accentuated this polarization. So now you have kind of three main poles, like Le Pen, Macron, and also the candidates on the radical left, Jean-Luc Mélenchon. So let's say the fact that Emmanuel Macron attracted all the moderate voters on the left, on the right, that he could create this big kind of, let's say, more centrist polls, have made it more obvious than the rest of the electorate now favors the extremes, be it on the right or on the left.
Do you think that it is correct to describe France, and I suppose more broadly Europe, into just two opposing sides? Or is this what French analysts are calling tri-polarisation? So I guess the emergence of three blocs, populist right, populist left, and also the centrist liberal bloc.
Yeah, that's what happened. That is the result of the first round of this election. So now there will be, let's say, kind of a third round, which will be the general elections in May. And maybe that could correct slightly maybe the landscape. But that's where we stand now, definitely. Mm.
And in terms of the amount of people supporting Le Pen and what they think, do you think this might force reform of our institutions like the EU or perhaps even the end of them?
I don't think it will have really an impact, you know. I mean, her ideas are too extreme. For example, she wants the French law to have precedence on the EU law. She wants to even change the French constitution, you know, through a referendum so that she can start to decide those laws on, you know, excluding foreigners for social benefits, etc. A series of measures that are in complete contradiction to the EU. So, I mean, that's not what the voters maybe want, you know. Nobody, Emmanuel Macron said, somehow this election is also a referendum on the EU, a vote pro or for the EU, and I think it's clear in everybody's mind. And in France, I mean, there is not such an opposition to the EU, such a dislike that you have seen in the UK, for example.
Yeah. Now, from midnight on Saturday, French media houses are required to enter an electoral blackout period. Can you tell us more about that and why it's done?
Well, this is a French tradition. You don't have, by law, the right to give any poll, any indication of any result, which doesn't apply, by the way, to the countries around France. So if you want, you can go on the internet and find some of the polls. But it is supposed to forbid to influence the vote because from, I think, 7 o'clock, 7, 8 o'clock in the morning till 8, it depends also on the cities, in the evening, people are voting and you should not influence their vote by you know, giving polls that says this or this candidate is winning.
Yeah, we see that Le Monde is starting an English language digital edition, and the timing of that obviously is connected to the election.
Oh, well, yes, sure. I mean, I don't know if they will go on with that, but definitely, yes, it's linked to the election.
Thank you very much. That's Florence Biedermann there talking to us from Paris. Now, still to come on the programme, the Westminster Watcher Vincent McAvinney will review the papers. Kat Hannah brings us the latest urbanism news, and Andrew Muller offers his weekly assessment on the stories we may have missed. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Last month, the Solomon Islands announced a security deal with China, but refused to reveal more than that the arrangement is to tackle security threats and ensure a safe environment for investment as it diversifies its security relations. Well, lawmakers of the Pacific Island nation have urged their prime minister to make details of the deal public, and the United States, Japan, New Zealand and Australia have shared concerns about the security pact with China and its serious risks to a free and open Indo-Pacific. Well, I'm joined now by Fiona Wilson, Monocle's Tokyo Bureau, Bureau Chief and Asia Editor. Fiona, what do we actually know about this deal between the Solomon Islands and China? They've been very, shall we call it, discreet.
Yeah, that's a very, very good point, Georgina. I think the lack of transparency has been one of the main issues about this pact. I mean, interestingly, there was a leaked draft of the pact, which probably gave people some idea of what it's about. And if you hear from China and the Solomon Islands, this is about social order, which means Chinese troops can be deployed if there's social unrest and China wants to protect its interests in the Solomon Islands. We saw riots there last year when Chinese interests were being burned. There were terrible riots, and they don't want that to happen again. They say it's about humanitarian assistance. Now, slightly more shadowy is what it means in terms of China's military. There's a suggestion that military vessels will be able to restock there. They'll be able to dock and you know, take on supplies. And the bigger question, I think, the thing that really bothers this part of the world is, will it be the prelude to a Chinese military base in the backyard of Australia and New Zealand? And that's the key question, I think.
Mm. So tell us more about Japan's concerns on this.
Well, I mean, you know, Japan has been saying all week, it's been using that exact word. It said, we are watching with concern. They're extremely worried. I mean, you had the Chief Cabinet Secretary yesterday, Hirokazu Matsuno, saying it will have an impact on the region's security, that they take that as a given. And I think in this part of the world, we saw what happened with the South China Sea, which is where over a gradual process, China has effectively militarized a number of very small, barely call them islands, sandbanks in the South China Sea. Initially, they said they won't be militarized. And now what's happened is the sea is dotted with Chinese military bases, effectively. So I think that's a big concern for Japan. You know, it's on Japan's doorstep. It's the potential for, you know, the disruption of what Japan's big foreign policy aim is, you know, this free Indo-Pacific. They keep talking about this commitment to a free Indo-Pacific. And Jacinda Ardern is actually in Japan at the moment. She's in Tokyo. She and Fumio Kishida, the Japanese prime minister, reaffirmed that commitment to a free, open Indo-Pacific yesterday. And today they announced a intelligence and security agreement, which Jacinda Ardern was very keen to say was not, you know, aimed at China, that New Zealand has these agreements with other countries, including Spain. It's quite normal, and it can be anything, yes, security and intelligence, but also in natural disasters like the Tongan volcanic eruption. Japan shared its satellite imagery. So, yeah, it's a very interesting moment for this part of the world.
Mm. I wonder if it's really a diplomatic failure on the part of Australia, because, of course, they provided policing support to the Solomons until, I think, that was under a 2017 security treaty. And I mean, this must be a major blow to them.
Oh, definitely. I mean, you're absolutely right. So, yes, there was this treaty in 2017. There's a question mark over whether Australian troops looked after Chinese interests in the riots. It was suggested that they didn't, you know, which was sort of used as an excuse. But no, I think it's definitely been seen as a huge foreign policy failure. Scott Morrison is, it's in the middle of an election campaign there, and the opposition is obviously bringing this up. You know, Penny Wong, the shadow foreign minister, said it's the worst foreign policy failure in the Pacific since the Second World War for Australia. So it's going down extremely badly in Australia.
Mm. And so can anything actually be done to counter this?
Well, I mean, the thing is that, you know, the pact is now signed. The White House is and was already planned to be sending a delegation to the Solomon Islands, you know, in a matter of days, which is why the timing of the signing was considered quite strange. They can't wind back what's happened. And, you know, already before it even was signed, they were already raising their concerns. They knew it was going to be signed. It was signed. The Prime Minister of the Solomon Islands has said it won't undermine regional peace, but there's no doubt that it is causing a lot of problems in the region, and it's ruffling feathers.
And it seems odd that even his own MPs don't appear to know the detail and are urging him to make it public.
Yeah, I mean, that is a very interesting thing. He's saying it's, you know, it's a matter, it's sort of some things don't have to be made public. And I think it's clearly it's in his interest not to make it public, because I think many people feel that the switch from Taipei to Beijing, which happened in 2019 when he became prime minister for the fourth time, that was really the sign that the, you know, the Solomon Islands was going to pivot towards China, and it's not going down very well at home. So, you know, all the polls at home show that most people would rather not have this kind of engagement with China. So from his point of view, it's not very, you know, it doesn't please the electorate at home.
Mm. And finally, as you say, Jacinda Ardern is actually in Japan today. What else is on that agenda, do you think?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, it's she's doing a bit of a tour of Asia. And, you know, it's really about reaffirming commitments. It's important in this part of the world that the democracies within this region are standing together. That's sort of the common policy thrust at the moment. So you've got the Quad that Australia is also involved in, and India, US, and New Zealand is also showing that, you know, it's standing with Japan in this bid for you know, to keep the Pacific open.
Fiona, thank you very much indeed. That was Monocle's Tokyo Bureau Chief, Fiona Wilson. Now, here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. Officials in Shanghai have said they will tighten the enforcement of lockdown measures as COVID numbers in the Chinese city continue to surge. The new measures include installing electronic door alarms to prevent those infected from leaving their homes. The former president of Honduras, Juan Orlando Hernandez, has been extradited to the United States to face drug trafficking charges. Hernandez, who governed Honduras until January, was put on board a specially chartered plane to New York. The UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson is holding high-level security talks with his Indian counterpart Narendra Modi. The pair, who are meeting in New Delhi, are also expected to discuss a trade deal ahead of fresh negotiations next week. And Group Le Monde has launched an English-language digital edition ahead of the French presidential election runoff on Sunday. You can find out more about it at monocle.com/minute or by downloading tomorrow's edition of The Stack. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Today, April the 22nd, is Earth Day, which marks the anniversary of the birth of the modern environmental movement in 1970. For more on that and a roundup of climate news, we join Monocle's contributor in Edmonton, Sheena Rossiter. Sheena, hello to you. Earth Day, how important is this day now?
Well, it's really more important than ever. It's something inescapable that we think about all the time. People are suffering from eco-anxiety, about concerns about the future. And as you mentioned, it started back in 1970, and it was simply because there was a huge oil well that basically blew up off the coast of California, and it just damaged a considerable amount of wildlife. And disaster and activists, they kind of realize, well, we really need to start taking the environment a little bit more seriously. So if you really think about like the history of the planet Earth, if only in the past 50 years are we actually really taking this more seriously and really looking at the environment, it's kind of led us to the moment that we are at today, which is kind of on the brink of climate disaster.
Mm. And of course, one of the biggest impacts of climate change at the moment is the conflict in Ukraine. Why is that, though?
Yeah, this is something that most people don't tend to think about, because obviously you think about the other atrocities that war and conflict tends to bring. But war is a really big polluter. All those military tanks and all that equipment that comes out into the battlefields and that gets shot down almost immediately, it really takes a lot of fuel, and it's not likely that you're going to see electric tanks anytime soon. So as that conflict gets drawn on longer and longer, which it is expected to as Russia continues its invasion of Ukraine, that is going to continue to lead to one of the biggest polluters that we have at the moment. And that's along with, of course, other conflicts that are all that are happening around the world at the moment as well.
Mm. And I mean, climate change really does have a big ripple effect on other parts of our lives. How is it leading to a decline in the insect population, and what does that mean for us?
Yeah, of course. Most people aren't really fans of insects, unless you're an entomologist, of course. But they are really important to our survival as a human species and just other species in general. So a new study that's out from University College London, insect numbers have plunged in some parts of the world, and it's partly due to climate change and it's partly due to intensive agriculture. So the combined pressure of just like a warming climate and farming, it's just created like such a drastic drop in insect population. And we have to kind of acknowledge this before these species are lost forever. But preserving these habitats, it could be quite difficult to get vital insects to thrive and survive.
And why do we need them to? What are the repercussions for us if they don't?
Well, of course, you know, bees are huge pollinators, essentially for all the food that we eat. So plummeting populations and insects around the world causing this so-called insect apocalypse, it is a rather large concern for us. So there's been a bit of a mixed picture of what types of insects are on decline, but nearly 20,000 insect species, including bees, ants, butterflies, grasshoppers, and dragonflies in about 6,000 different locations around the world have been on decline, according to this study. And it's all mostly been in areas where there's like high intensity agriculture and substantial warming. So in those areas, the numbers have plunged by about 49% compared to more untouched places that don't have as much agriculture activity. But researchers have said that there is cause for hope in that setting aside some areas of land for a natural refuge for insects where they have shade and they can survive in hot weather, that could maybe help save some of these insects. But that's going to be something that we'll have to look at.
Mm. And finally, forest fire season's begun. Isn't this earlier than usual?
Absolutely. Definitely a lot earlier than usual. But in North America, forest fires are starting to rage through several states in the Southwest, namely in Arizona. So a forest fire there has burned more than 20,000 hectares. And as of yesterday afternoon, 0% of it was actually contained. So this is the Tunnel Fire, and its flames have basically had gusts of up to 50 miles per hour, and it's just very hard for firefighters to even contain this because it's too dangerous for them to go out because of the wind. So far, about 25 structures have been lost in that blaze in the area where it is burning, and some 765 homes have been evacuated. But unfortunately, Georgina, this is expected to be sort of our new normal, to have forest fire season starting in April as opposed to starting in July or August. So this is something that's going to kind of foreshadow what's going to happen this year, not just in the United States, but also in Canada, where by the end of August, there's expected to be massive forest fires in the continent.
Sheena, thank you very much indeed. That's our Sheena Rossiter there on The Globalist. It is just coming up to 8:34 in Zurich. That's 7:34 here in London. And we'll continue now with today's papers. Joining me in the studio is Vincent McAvinia, political reporter and a regular voice here on Monocle 24. You're also a big Westminster watcher, Vincent.
Mm-hmm.
And Westminster, very, very interesting at the moment, even if the main protagonist is actually in India.
Yeah, very interesting. Prime Minister Boris Johnson gave some pretty grumpy interviews yesterday on his trip to India because he really couldn't escape the drama in Westminster. Not only in the past fortnight has he become the first Prime Minister in British history to be found to have broken the law whilst in office, he is the first to be put to the Parliamentary Standards Privileges Committee, for his behaviour. He is accused of misleading the House of Commons when he said at the outset of the Partygate scandal that he had no knowledge of anything like this going on. And the foundation of British parliamentary democracy is that it's expected in the Commons chamber that ministers, the Prime Minister, when they go there, will speak the truth, because you're not actually allowed to. You can say anything you want in the chamber if you're a member. You can say things that outside someone could sue you for libel for with parliamentary privilege, but you're never allowed to call someone a liar. You can use clever phrases like economical with the truth, but you can't accuse someone of being a liar. But this committee is going to look after the police and the complete their investigation and the Sue Gray report comes out, whether or not Boris Johnson misled the House of Commons. That means lied to the House of Commons. And if they find that, that is a resignation matter, because you have breached the code of standards that all members of the government are meant to abide by.
Now, there was some doubt whether actually this investigation would take place, because MPs had to vote on that. Clearly, then, he's lost the backing of his party if it went through.
Yeah, initially it was thought, well, Prime Minister Johnson's got a majority, he'll be fine. But then we started to see that there were more letters going into the 1922 backbench committee, which is the committee that can trigger a leadership race. You had people like Mark Harper, who's a former minister, put one in, and others start to speak out in the past couple of days saying they simply couldn't defend the Prime Minister anymore. So Downing Street, in a panic, tried to put down an amendment on Labour's move to have this investigation by the Standards Committee, but they hadn't actually read it, because it already said, after the police investigation has fully reported, because there could be more fines coming as more parties are investigated over the coming weeks. They put on an amendment saying, yeah, OK, you can do this, but only after the police investigations and Sue Gray report's done. Well, it already said that. So then yesterday they U-turned massively, ditched that, dropped a three-line whip to a one-line whip, and then the thing was effectively nodded through in the Commons because they knew that they didn't have the support, not because some people in the party might have voted for it, which they would have done, but they simply weren't going to vote along with the government because they didn't want to have to defend this anymore. So it is a huge problem. One thing I did note as well, Jeremy Hunt, who is the person who ran against Boris Johnson at the last leadership election, has been pretty active in his communication with constituents. It's being reported this morning in The Guardian and elsewhere that he says, you know, he simply can't and won't defend the Prime Minister essentially on this. I think we are starting to see a field developing for people potentially to run against him at some point in the summer. I don't think Rishi Sunak will be in that anymore, but Liz Truss and Jeremy Hunt, I think, are the two to watch now.
If he's excused by the committee, and he might be, then presumably it just carries on as normal. But just looking at the main makeup of the committee, I think it has a Labour Party chair, but it's majority Tory.
Yes, but he has recused himself. So because Chris Bryant, who is the chair, has publicly made his kind of views clear on the behaviour of the Prime Minister, he's a pretty vocal MP, he has recused himself from the potential proceedings as well. So we will see, you know, how that stands up, whether or not they say it's a partisan thing. But looming over the Prime Minister at all times is the fact that Downing Street could get hit by more fines for not just him, but many staff all over the next couple of weeks. Now, the only reprieve they're getting is the Met Police said yesterday that they, because of the local elections coming up, they won't issue any fines before then, which seems like a quite strange interpretation of the Purdah rules. You know, that's not something that you really... They're worried about being accused of being political, but really, I think the Met Police have got bigger problems at the moment with their own reputation.
Yeah. Now, CNN has problems too. CNN Plus says that it's shutting after just 3 weeks.
Yeah, it's an incredibly bad week for streaming services. We've seen Netflix shedding subscribers. We've seen the kind of questioning of the fundamentals of the economics of all of them. And CNN had decided to launch this CNN Plus service, which I remember seeing the advert a couple of months ago and just thought, who's going to pay for, you know, people pay for sort of newspaper subscriptions and they get sort of additional bonus content with those. But CNN is a news channel, its website is free. Who would be paying for extra content from them when people are probably already feeling newsed out, to be honest? So after just 3 weeks, they're going to shut down this service. They apparently put $300 million into it, potentially as well another $100 million advertising it. They'd signed big contracts with people like Chris Wallace, who they'd pulled over from CNN for reportedly $9 million a year, Casey Hunt from NBC News, Audie Cornish from NPR, Eva Longoria was doing a cooking show, and a travel show in Mexico. So they had invested huge sums in this, and it is incredibly embarrassing for them to be ditching it after just 3 weeks. And of course, Fox News last night, Donald Trump putting out a full statement about it, just pretty gleeful. And it is partially because CNN has just moved in a big media merger with Warner Bros. Discovery. So perhaps there's a rethinking of corporate strategy. But it's a pretty bad time for CNN because of the whole Chris Cuomo affair as well that they've just gotten over. They recently lost their CEO in that battle because of an interwork relationship. It is it's a pretty embarrassing move. And it just shows that, you know, I think the wave of put everything to streaming, get everything on streaming, and something we're seeing here in the UK of the government constantly saying, oh, we'll sell off Channel 4 because look at Netflix. Streaming did very well in the pandemic, but people are cancelling subscriptions now because they know that they're not just going to sit at home watching as much stuff anymore.
Absolutely. And generationally, we're looking at a big shift to podcasts too.
Huge shift to podcasts. You know, it is the number one growth area. But even that is starting to approach a slight saturation because it's becoming now, you know, you sort of had the people who were the natural adopters who had gone into it and you know, created their own brand and created their shows. And now you're just seeing it as a token thing that, okay, every celebrity, every news presenter, everyone needs a podcast. And it's just slightly too many at the moment, I think.
Slightly annoying for those of us whose only skill is doing that. New York Times now. Disney is embroiled in a huge row with the governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis.
Yeah, this is really interesting. And I think it's not just about Disney. It is going to be a much wider thing over the next couple of years. Ron DeSantis is second to Donald Trump, the likely candidate for the Republican nomination in 2024. He is someone who is, you know, he was a Trump huge fan. That's what got him into the governorship. He released a pretty cringy video with his own baby sort of praising Trump and his family. But he is someone with a bit of a pedigree. He's got an Ivy League education. He is a smart mind, despite what you think of his political positions. And this is all to do with Florida's so-called Don't Say Gay bill, which is similar to Section 28 in the UK, which basically blocks any kind of mention of homosexuality in schools. It's in primary schools at the moment, but the wording is kind of vague. It could be used higher up. It's a pretty nasty bill. And it's trying to also, you know, curtail it. Basically creates an impetus as well that if a student is showing that they might be gay or that they might be non-gender conforming, that then there's an onus on the teachers to tell the parents this. And it's turned pretty nasty. And now you're seeing copycat bills across the United States. So, but Ron DeSantis, you know, the Republicans very much used to be the party of business. And that's something they trumpeted. But this shows that they are now the party who will turn on business because it is doing two things. It's showing that if you speak out against things, and, you know, Disney is the biggest employer, the biggest tourist draw in Central Florida. It brings in billions of dollars to the state in business. It pays millions in taxes. But it had this deal done by Walt Disney himself 55 years ago where they basically had their own tax center, and this is something replicated elsewhere in Florida, actually, but they had their own kind of tax center, and they also had basically like their own district, and they could control the planning laws, and they even ran their own emergency services. But now this has all been disbanded in 2 days by Ron DeSantis, because Disney, despite having 38 lobbyists just in Florida's capital, they pay money to everyone, Republican and Democrat, in contributions to campaigns to make sure they can effectively kind of get what they want. They've now taken real aim by the Republicans. Ron DeSantis taking away these special measures, which could create problems for the company in doing what it wants to going forward. It's a headache for the company because internally you had LGBT employees and allies coming out and saying that the company should have taken a bolder stance on this, and whether they maintain that bold stance, because Ron DeSantis now is getting a huge platform for his presidential run, saying that he is taking on the so-called woke companies. He says Californian executives shouldn't be enforcing their views and laws on and rules on Floridians, and it's giving him a real national platform to a company which, you know, Disney has armies and armies of people to avoid it getting into scandals like this, to deal with things like this. It's the first time I can think of in my life that they've really run into a huge scandal.
Absolutely, and huge implications, as you say, for the political future in the US. Finally, let's have a quick look at Ukrainian students who are doing incredibly well in European classrooms.
Yeah, this is a really lovely story in the London Times this morning, and it's from reports from teachers in both Italy and France, which have taken in thousands of Ukrainian students. And whilst, you know, it's maybe tricky to get your head around some subjects when you're still trying to maybe learn those languages, the one universal language is math. And it's being reported in both countries that Ukrainian students are absolute whizzes with it, and that they are on average at least a year ahead of where their domestic students are when it comes to their maths ability. So it is pretty nice to hear that, that they're doing all right in that. And it's also being said that because many of them were already multilingual, learning both Ukrainian and Russian at home, as well as a lot of English, they're getting to grips with Italian and French pretty quickly. But they're being really praised for how much, how talented they are at maths from their teachers from home, and it's making European teachers wonder whether or not they should be pushing their own students more on that.
Vincent, thank you very much indeed. That was the political reporter Vincent McAvinney.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Well, it's time now to take a look at the latest stories from the world of urbanism. Kat Hanna, an urban affairs commentator, joins me here in the studio. Good morning to you, Kat.
Good morning.
Now, let's go to Oxford Street. Not the most beautiful street, but there are bits of it that are worth saving, or according to some, although lots and lots of controversy about knocking down various buildings. Tell us more.
Yes, absolutely. So the building in question here is Marks & Spencer, so sort of flagship British retailer. Store, I think, built in the 1920s. And this application, which has currently been proposed, essentially for a pretty comprehensive demolition and then a rebuild for what's kind of Marks & Spencer are calling sort of a retail store fit for the future, and obviously combining some offices, etc. One of the crux of this here is this tension between demolition and rebuild for a sort of purpose-built, you know, the architects have called it kind of Tesla-style building, energy efficient, promoting its kind of carbon credentials in that respect, versus preservation, retrofit, and actually rather than demolishing that building and obviously the carbon impact that that would have, reusing it. So this is, I think, you know, it's an interesting article because, what you know, it's been covered by the BBC, by the Evening Standard. I think it's going to be something we see happening a lot more, is again this tension between retrofit and between, you know, demolition and rebuild.
And of course, there's a big debate around the loss of Oxford Street's character with the loss of buildings like that and all these American candy shops opening where they used to be old retailers.
Absolutely. And there is obviously, yes, a heritage element to this as well. And, you know, the idea of, you know, character of a street, and actually, you know, how can you do, for example, sensitive retrofitting to keep, as you said, some of that heritage, you know, without it being lost. So interestingly, actually, you know, there was a report, an independent report down into the carbon performance of both the proposed schemes and of a potential retrofit scheme. And that was actually backed by a heritage body. So you're seeing this alliance between obviously those who, for environmental reasons, would prefer to go to retrofit, and those for heritage reasons would also like to see that kind of approach.
Yeah. Now, let's turn to have a look at this Bloomberg story about lack of representation, racial representation, that is, at higher levels of business and gender representation too. So, tell us more about this story.
Yeah, so this is an interesting, it's a series of essays that Bloomberg City Lab are running, and it's the essay collection is quite a nice one, which is called The Future of Work for the Rest of Us, because often, you know, it's, I think, highlighting that when we have these discussions about the future of work, it's often very focused on tech jobs, it's often focused on, you know, automation, where are these high growth companies going to be? So it's actually looking at what if we broadened our understanding of the word innovation to include businesses, often those, you know, who are run, and the article that this one in particular looks at the role of black women as entrepreneurs. And says, again, rather than just purely focusing on, you know, high, fast tech, what's often these quite kind of, you know, sexy companies that tend to attract a lot of investment, a lot of intention. The author herself is, I think, from Seattle, you know, obviously a city very much associated with that. And the example she uses is her aunt, who ran a very successful hair salon, and saying, actually, you know, we've got these small businesses that are really successful, that, yes, could grow further, but let's not overlook the contribution they're making. So if we're thinking about resilient and inclusive growth, it's all those types of businesses that need to be understood.
Absolutely. And finally, a very quick look at the New York Times and this story about Portland in Oregon and the light rail system.
Yeah, so this is a story, you know, a lot of cities, you know, and, you know, we've seen this in London with things like, you know, the LTNs are grappling with how do you reduce driving in order to obviously, you know, meet some of those climate targets. Portland's an interesting one because I think, you know, perception-wise, it's seen as very progressive. There has been a lot of investment into walkable neighbourhoods, into bike lanes, as you noted, you know, into light rail. But at the same time, the amount of cars on the road has risen. So inevitably, there's often this, well, obviously the answer is we need more roads. There would be a plenty of experts who would say more roads is not the answer. You will get more traffic. So it's how do we really address climate change whilst also addressing those challenges too?
And what solutions are they going to implement? I mean, we've heard the suggestions, but are they likely to happen?
It's an interesting one. There have been proposals for obviously more funding into, you know, active transport. That obviously could mean higher taxes, though. So unsurprisingly and sadly, you know, that has been kicked back. So at the moment, there is still, I think, quite a strong appetite for further investment in roads, into kind of, you know, wide roadening programs as well, in the idea that that might help ease congestion. But again, many examples from the past would show you just put more lanes in, you'll invite more cars into those lanes. So it really has to be a comprehensive package. And it also has to look at how the city is laid out as well, because, you know, biking, walking, rail, that works really well in that dense, you know, in the city. But as the article highlights, out in the suburbs, it's much harder to have that kind of lifestyle, and reliance on the car is obviously still there.
Kat, thank you very much indeed. That's Kat Hannah there, and this is The Globalist on Monocle 24. And finally on today's programme, Monocle's contributing editor, Andrew Muller, brings us his own unique take on what the last 7 days have taught us.
We learned this week of another puncture in F. Scott Fitzgerald's maxim that there are no second acts in American lives. Seriously, I kick off with a highfalutin literary citation, and this prosaic slapstick is what I get.
It's been a long week.
Fair enough. We also learned, looking into it further, like the diligent researchers and or friendless pedants that we are, that like pretty much every quote on the internet, that one is wrong. What Fitzgerald actually first wrote in a 1932 essay called My Lost City was, I once thought that there were no second acts in American lives, i.e. a sentiment more or less the polar opposite of the popular attribution, happy to help. We do appear to have deviated somewhat from the point.
Come on.
Just get on with it.
Where were we? Right. We learned that Fitzgerald's misquote was wrong, but the actual quote might be right, in that we learned that actually America is frankly generous to a profligate fault in its dispensing of second acts. For we learned that the headline attraction at the Market Hotel in Brooklyn on July 8th will be a singer-songwriter by the name of John Hinckley Jr., which might sound familiar.
He was wounded. My God. He was
The president was hit. He is in stable condition. All this information. The president was hit.
Yes, the very same. And we have learned, somewhat depressingly, that there appear to be sufficient morbid weirdos at large to have sold out the Market Hotel in advance. Unless, of course, this is an undue slight upon pure-hearted fans of popular song, sincerely enticed by this singularly drab species of strum and drone.
Everybody's fighting here and there. Wanna see some love.
So we learned that, incredibly, attempting to assassinate the President of the United States might only be the second worst thing Hinckley has ever done. Come on, it was right there. Where's the gong?
In the world, I wanna see some love.
Staying in the United States, frankly, for no better reason than the fact that the enthusiasm its citizens display for electing obvious nitwits and certifiable kooks to public office makes the compilation of whimsical news monologues such as this a pretty breezy morning's work. Thanks, America. We learned that one Republican state senator in Tennessee is perhaps yet to crack the second volume of Sir Ian Kershaw's magisterial biography of, well, take it away, Senator.
For 2 years, Hitler lived on the streets and practiced his oratory and his body language and how to connect with the masses, and then went on to lead a life that got him in the history books. So a lot of these people, it's not a dead end. They can come out of this, these homeless camps and have a productive life.
Tennessee State Senator and living contradiction to the theory of nominative determinism, Frank Nicely, from whom we learned that homeless people should be more like Adolf Hitler? There having been literally nobody else in human history to have climbed from relative poverty to national leadership who could possibly have been cited as some sort of encouraging example.
And that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
And yes, we chose Abraham Lincoln's words read by Barack Obama specifically to annoy Senator Nicely. And indeed, if we may make so bold, annoy the senator nicely. Tough crowd. Elsewhere, specifically Taiwan, we learned that someone had endured a worse day at work than you had, unless, of course, the central protagonist of this story is among Monocle 24's many listeners in Taiwan, and certainly it seems likely that what with one thing and another, they suddenly have more time to catch up with their podcasts. We learned that on Wednesday, viewers of the morning news on CTS witnessed the screen suddenly light up with somewhat disconcerting news tickers, as now read by Monocle 24 staff. These included:
on the brink of war,
Taipei hit by People's Liberation Army ground force missiles,
vessel explodes in Taipei harbor, facilities and ships destroyed.
We learned via the channel's swift and abject apology that these were mock-ups created for emergency service disaster response drills broadcast by mistake, and that those responsible would be, we quote, severely punished. But if we have learned one thing this week, it is, of course, that there is always a way back, however disheartening one's present circumstances may seem, and that the hapless technician responsible for this fabulous balls-up need only look to the example of a bedraggled and penniless Austrian watercolourist who... Well, fair enough. And we learned that it is perhaps imprudent to believe everything one reads on the internet. Indeed. But we learned that the government of the United Kingdom intends, by golly, to do something about this. New proposals will make illegal, on pain of fairly socking fines, the writing or hosting of fake reviews, and will compel companies to take reasonable steps to check that reviews posted on their websites are genuine. At which point, we must dash, as we definitely don't have another few hundred five-star reviews for these monologues to rattle up before this thing gets signed off on. For Monocle 24, I'm Andrew Miller.
Thank you very much, Andrew. And that's all we have time for today. Thanks to our producers, Rhys James, Emma Searle, Charlie Filmer-Court and Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. Our researchers, Lillian Fawcett and Samson Mbogo. And our studio manager, Nora Hull, with editing assistance from Christy Evans. After the headlines, there's more music on the way and lots of sharp programming. And The Briefing is live at midday in London. And The Globalist will return at the same time on Monday. I'm Georgina Godwin. I'll be with you tomorrow, Saturday. But in the meantime, thank you for listening.